Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, July 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Republican Party National Convention continues in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
My fellow Republicans, President Trump asked me to speak to this convention in the name of unity.
President Biden addressed the black supporters in the battleground state of Nevada on Tuesday. South Africa's Home Affairs Minister assures dignified service for refugees. The Eswatini High Court sentences two members of parliament to 43 years in jail. We'll get reaction. Guinean lawyers embark on a two-week strike to protest what they say are arbitrary arrests. Rwandan President Paul Kagame is on the verge of re-election for his fourth term.
We know that he's won over 99% of the vote, and I think he was 99.14%, but I think it changed to 99.15%.
And Nigeria is to begin crude oil refining in August. The stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Republican Party National Convention continues today, Wednesday, in the Midwestern city of Milwaukee in the state of Wisconsin. Former President Donald Trump and his vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance, who were officially nominated as the party's candidates for the 2024 presidential election, are expected to accept the nomination tomorrow, Thursday. The delegates heard from various speakers on Tuesday, including Nikki Haley, who was one of the harshest critics of Trump during the Republican Party primary.
My fellow Republicans, President Trump asked me to speak to this convention in the name of unity. It was a gracious invitation, and I was happy to accept. I'll start by making one thing perfectly clear. Donald Trump has my strong endorsement, period. Our country is at a critical moment. We have a choice to make. For more than a year, I said a vote for Joe Biden is a vote for President Kamala Harris. After seeing the debate, everyone knows it's true. If we have four more years of Biden, or a single day of Harris, our country will be badly worse off. For the sake of our nation, we have to go with Donald Trump. But there's more to it than that. We should acknowledge that there are some Americans who don't agree with Donald Trump 100% of the time. I happen to know some of them. And I want to speak to them tonight. My message to them is simple. You don't have to agree with Trump 100% of the time to vote for him. Take it from me, I haven't always agreed with President Trump. But we agree more often than we disagree. We agree on keeping America strong. We agree on keeping America safe. And we agree that Democrats have moved so far to the left that they're putting our freedoms in danger.
That was Nikki Haley, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and one of the harshest critics of former President Trump during the Republican Party primary. President Joe Biden addressed the black supporters in the battleground state of Nevada on Tuesday, his first campaign appearance since the assassination attempt on his Republican rival, former President Donald Trump. He linked the attack on Trump to racial and gun violence, imploring Americans to condemn violence in any form. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadikuswari has the report.
Striking the right note to win an election after an assassination attempt on a rival? That's the challenge facing U.S. President Joe Biden.
We all have a responsibility to lower the temperature and condemn violence in any form.
Speaking in front of black voters in Las Vegas, Nevada, Tuesday, he did that by linking the shooting that injured Donald Trump in his Pennsylvania rally Saturday with violence perpetrated against African Americans, including George Floyd, who was killed by a white police officer in 2020, and to victims of gun violence, calling to reenact a U.S. ban on assault weapons that expired in 2004.
An AR-15 was used in the shooting of Donald Trump. This was an assault weapon that killed so many others, including children. It's time to outlaw them. I did it once and I will do it again.
The shooting inflicted only a minor injury to Donald Trump. The former president and Republican nominee arrived with a bandaged right ear Monday at his party's national convention in Milwaukee to a raucous welcome. For Biden, whose weak debate performance last month triggered questions about his age and mental acuity, the assassination attempt on his rival adds an additional layer of complication, said University of Chicago's political scientist William Howell via Zoom.
You've got to, on the one hand, allay concerns about his fitness for office. You've got to create separation from the opposition, the Republican Party, which is enjoying a moment of ascendance. And you've got to call for unity and to disavow political violence. And to do all those three things simultaneously is extraordinarily difficult for anybody.
Currently, Biden lags behind Trump nationally and in various swing states, including Nevada. Aiming to win black support, Biden contrasted his policies with his rivals. He mocked the term black jobs that Trump often uses.
Folks, I know what a black job is. It's a vice president of the United States.
Biden repeated calls for Americans to treat each other not as enemies. Trump, uncharacteristically subdued after the attempt on his life, has also called for unity. But many expect the calm to last only temporarily, with campaigning set to intensify following the party's political conventions. Patsy Wadikuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame is on the verge of re-election for his fourth term in office. This, as preliminary results from Monday's presidential election show, he has gained 99.15% of the vote. President Kagame has ruled Rwanda since 2000. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo is in Rwanda covering the election.
Well, I think the results we had yesterday has not changed as much. So we know that he's won over 99% of the vote, and I think he was 99.14%, but I think it changed to 99.15%, somewhere where I've seen those results. And sure enough, the opposition was not even able to combine to get the 1%, so between the Democratic Green Party candidate and the more of the independent leading candidate, Mpayimana. So that's what the results are so far, but I think that number might change. Who knows? From what the chairwoman told us yesterday, that those were just preliminary numbers, and that we'll know more, you know, when they get final numbers, they'll share that with us.
Even though they are still counting the results, this margin of victory is almost the same as the 2017 vote. Has President Kagame spoken about the results in terms of what this might mean for his own legacy in Rwandan politics?
I mean, I think yesterday, actually, as soon as the preliminary results were announced, He, you know, had started doing basically, it's not a victory speech, I should say an acceptance speech. I think he was watching with other parties. He was watching with family, colleagues and supporters and friends. So he spoke a little bit, I think, from what I could understood, the little Kinyarwanda that I could understood and the translation from my cameraman. But all along, I think President Kagame's vision and what he's talked about has been, you know, keeping what he's done the past 30 years. I'd say past 30 years because he's been there since, you know, the 1994 genocide. A lot of people think of him as the savior. He's the one who got them out of that. And after that, he occupied various positions, obviously, before he finally became president. And he's been here for almost the whole generation. He wants to keep, at least for the people who support him and the people who kind of judge his performance, the past generation, talk about the fact that he had brought stability. He had brought internal security. You know, the economy has developed. So President Kagame talks about that. That's what he wants to do. That's what he wants to continue moving forward.
That's VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo speaking with us from the Rwanda capital, Kigali, where she has been covering that country's presidential and parliamentary elections. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 17th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. South Africa's new Home Affairs Minister, Leon Schreiber, says those seeking asylum in South Africa will be treated with dignity and respect. Tuso Kumalo reports from Cape Town.
At the Cape Town Refugee Reception Center, Home Affairs Minister Leon Schreiber praised the center for using an online system to deal with the long queues usually seen at Home Affairs offices.
Infrastructure is quite impressive. Lots of embracing of digital technologies to move away from the manual use of files and paperwork.
Schreiber was speaking to journalists Tuesday on his first visit to the center since his appointment last month. He spoke with refugees at the center and they indicated they face big challenges. Priscilla Chuloi is a refugee from Cameroon who has lived in South Africa for 20 years. She has struggled for more than 10 years to get legal status for her children, who were born in South Africa, and now Home Affairs staff say her file is missing.
I am immensely affected. I don't have peace. I'm psychologically traumatized. I don't have peace because the school is on my case. Ma'am, we need your daughter's document to register her for the matric. And I don't have documents to give.
Adam Ayabagabo, a refugee from Burundi, says corruption at refugee reception centers is another problem.
Some officials here, they want the people to they make the people to struggle to get their paper. So they want to people to bribe. So that's why, but for so long now, start to become nice now. Because they help me nice, I get my ID, I'm going home now.
Human rights groups also have said there is evidence that immigration staff often seek bribes to process paperwork. Schreiber says ending corruption is his number one priority.
Corruption issue, I think there are some things that seem quite small but can make a difference that we saw here today. The camera monitoring at every station, physical barriers to prevent people from passing money back and forth. Those are sound like small things, but I think that they are lessons that we can take forward.
The government has acknowledged the refugee system faces a major backlog of unprocessed documents. It blames a large number of economic migrants who incorrectly apply for asylum to legalize their stay in the country. The growing number of asylum seekers and migrants has often resulted in xenophobic violence, with citizens accusing migrants of taking their jobs and overburdening public facilities such as hospitals. Reporting for VOA News in Cape Town, I am Tuso Kumalo.
A spokesperson for the Swaziland Transport Communications and Allied Workers Union has accused the Eswatini government of carrying out institutionalized judicial harassment. This after the Eswatini High Court on Tuesday handed down a 43-year jail sentence to two members of parliament, Basidi Mabuza and Tunde Deni Dube. They were arrested and jailed in July 2021 while delivering a petition calling for democratic reforms and charged with promoting political terrorism. Stix Kambule is the General Secretary of the Swaziland Transport Communications and Allied Workers Union. He tells me the sentences are part of the Eswatini government's effort to silence those calling for democratic reforms in the country. Government spokesperson Alpheus Dumalo did not respond to our request for comment.
He clearly understood that the strategy of this autocratic regime was to clear off the space on the ground so that they can proceed with this offensive on democratic calls and voices that are raising such sentiment. We say that because the regime sourced some mercenaries to kill and wipe out all critical voices that were supporting these MPs. The reaction on the ground, something they anticipated, because these calls or these strategies of the regime to wipe out and remove everyone that was critical on such questions, it was clear to say they were preparing to set up these MPs and any other ones, sacrificial lambs.
The reasons that they were sentenced was because they fomented protests. What were they found guilty of?
It's hilarious, really hilarious and ridiculous and shameful at this present time and age of our lives. Because they say the MPs are found guilty of murder, terrorism, and incitement charges. And when they qualify that, they say the MPs are guilty of murder because there was a protest and a driver of a vehicle hit on someone. Someone died. A doctor came to testify in court and say, yes, this particular patient died of injuries sustained out of a road accident. The driver came and say, all evidence is pointing towards a question of saying a driver hit on someone who was on the roadside. But the MPs, the conviction is that you are responsible for this. Terrorism charges, people were protesting and calling for some critical changes and democratic reforms within the country. And they are saying that constitutes terrorism and these MPs are responsible for it. And including the question of incitement, is that these MPs played a role to incite the people to call for democratic change. Very ridiculous.
Stix Kambule is the General Secretary of the Swaziland Transport Communications and Allied Workers Union. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. Lawyers in Guinea have announced a two-week strike beginning yesterday, Tuesday, to protest what they say are the arbitrary arrest of Guineans by the military government. Two leading members of the civil society group, the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, FNDC, were arrested last Tuesday. They were planning a protest to pressure the military government to return the country to democratic rule. Dauda Mohamed Kamara is the editor-in-chief at Espace FM. He tells me the strike will likely disrupt the ongoing trial of the 2009 stadium massacre, which is supposed to conclude on July 31st.
Good morning, James. Why are the lawyers going on strike? The problem is to denounce what is going on in the country, to arrest people, the gross violation of human rights. That's why, because of the FNDC members are arrested and other problems, some other people are arrested with no official document to say that why are they arrested or not. There's no official statement from the authorities. So that's why the lawyers saying that they are going on strike starting from this 16th of July.
But there is an ongoing trial about the September 28, 2009 so-called stadium massacre. What is the likely impact of the strike on this trial?
The impact of stadium massacre is very clear because the July 31st is going to be the day when we are going to know who is going to be grateful or not, who is going to stay in jail or not. That's the last day, if we can say like that. That's going to be the last day for this judgment. But if the lawyers are on strike, they're not going to assist today the process. So that means the process will also take another impact because everything will be stopped for that step again.
What is the update on the FNDC leaders whose arrest is sparking this call for a strike? What do we know about their whereabouts so far?
As for FNDC members, I was talking about with some lawyers, some defense lawyers. They even don't know, as to today, they don't know where are they kept. Nobody knows, even the Minister of Justice, even all the lawyers, let me say, nobody knows where they are keeping them. So these all are the problems pushing today the lawyers to go on strike, because the gross violation of human rights is very clear and they cannot stay like that without denouncing it. And that's why they are going on strike. Nobody can tell you today where is Fonike Mengesila, where is Biloba, and a lot of them. As you know about Sadiba Koulibaly, they arrested some soldiers behind Sadiba Koulibaly. They were free, but they have never been free because they are still kept by them. Nobody know where they are.
Dauda Mohamed Kamara is the editor-in-chief at SPAS FM. He was speaking with us from the Guinean capital, Conakry. Nigeria plans to resume the local refining of crude oil in early August, according to an announcement by the National Petroleum Authorities. The process, when it starts, will end years of endless idleness at Nigeria's state-owned refineries, and analysts say, if necessary, implemented could lower fuel prices. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Nigerian National Petroleum Company, or NNPC, made the announcement while addressing an emergency session at the National Assembly. Lawmakers called Monday's session to interrogate central bank authorities, the National Economic Management Team, and the NNPC about the country's economic standing. The chief executive officer of the NNPC, Mele Kyari, said one of the two Port Harcourt refineries in the oil-rich Niger Delta region will begin operations in about 2 weeks.
Latest by early August, the Port Harcourt refinery oil will start producing products. And of course, the new one will get to December, and Wari will also be in production. You know, we're very optimistic that by December, this country will be net exporter. That means combination of production coming from us and also from the Dangote refinery and other smaller producing companies.
The Dangote refinery is a privately owned facility built near Lagos. Nigeria's Minister of State of Petroleum Resources, Heineken Lokobiri, voiced optimism about the impact of the revived refineries.
Easiest way for Nigeria to come out of its economic problems is through the oil and gas sector. As a sector, we have a clear plan, you know, to gradually ramp up production.
This is not the first time that officials have announced the resumption of domestic oil refining. They made similar announcements in December of last year and back in March. On Monday, authorities said unforeseen technical difficulties hampered previous resumption dates. All four government-owned refineries, which can process about 450,000 barrels of crude per day, have been moribund for years, forcing the country to rely on imports to meet its petroleum needs, estimated at 66 million liters per day. Oil industry analyst Faith Mwadishi has voiced doubts the refineries will actually begin to operate again.
I'm just keeping my fingers crossed. I'm trying to be very optimistic about this because it would go a long way in reducing the hardship and perhaps also reducing the pump price of PMS especially. But being somebody who is in this sector,
the Nigerian oil industry has been hampered in recent years by theft and corruption. On Monday, the Nigeria Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative said about 140,000 barrels of crude oil were lost to theft every day between 2009 and 2018. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that's it for this Wednesday, July 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.